Hello, everyone, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 10 of Why Do You Care? I'm your co-host, Will, and I'm here with Katie.
Hello.
How you doing?
I'm okay. It's been 2 months since we recorded.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
That's appalling behavior on both our parts. Apologies to anyone that was expecting content over the last 2 months.
There was things happening. We were busy.
I feel like we didn't really have good excuses, actually.
Okay, well, great. Just sell us out.
Sorry. It's just a busy time of year, guys. No, well, I started a new job and you've been traveling loads. But anyway, poor excuse and very, very sorry. And we won't leave it as long next time.
Don't make promises.
Well,
if we don't keep them, we look like dicks.
I think I said that last time when we had another big break as well. And Now we've just repeated our poor behavior. Why am I not learning from my bad behavior?
At some point, we'll have an official like season break between season 2 and 3, which is instead of just informal breaks that happen because we're lazy, it'll be a break that we choose to be lazy for and announce ahead of time.
Yeah, like planned laziness instead of...
Planned laziness is totally excusable.
Yeah, instead of natural laziness that just comes to us. Yeah.
So what have you been watching while we've been gone?
So I now have a 5-hour commute. So I have been watching The Good Wife and I've watched 4 seasons nearly in 3 weeks.
Jesus Christ.
I know, I just power through it, man. And they are not short episodes. They're like 45-minute episodes. But yeah, I started watching it on a recommendation from my friend Betts and a whole bunch of people actually that I follow on Twitter that are all very into it. And I really like it. It's kind of...
What is The Good Wife? I've heard of it and I know nothing about it.
You know, like nothing about it.
None of the actors, none of the plots, nothing.
Yeah. So it's basically about, so this is in the first minute, so it's not a spoiler for me to say this, but basically a state's attorney is found guilty of corruption because he's been having affairs and sleeping with sex workers. The media basically have a big campaign against him and then he gets put in prison. This all happens within 5 minutes because he's doing a press conference about it. And then it's all focused on his wife, the titular good wife. And it's basically a story about how, and then it jumps 6 months after the credits. And she's started working at a law firm after having taken a break to basically be a Stepford wife for you know, the whole of their marriage, basically. And it's about her, you know, becoming independent from her husband potentially and all of that kind of thing. And it's basically it's like a legal drama, which I'm not usually into because, like, I don't know, nothing's ever beaten Ally McBeal for me in terms of like a drama about law. And like, I loved Ally McBeal in the 90s. So I've never really kind of bought into anything of that kind of ilk since then. But I really love this show. And it stars Juliana Margulies, who's she was in ER. That's like what I know her from. But she's so beautiful and wonderful and she's got real poise and she's a fantastic actress. But it's a really fun show because it's like kind of quite story of the week with some overarching themes. And it's got a good cast that aren't like super, super famous, which is nice. And it's got like Chris, what's his name? Bloody hell. Chris Noth from Sex and the City fame. He played Mr. Big. And it's got Alan Cumming, who I'm like obsessed with. It's got a actress called Archie Panjabi, who plays a fantastic character called Kalinda. But anyway, it's a really good cast. It's really pithy. It's quite fast paced. And it's like, I think, you know, we talk about like snack food. I feel like it's really nourishing snack food. You know, it's kind of in between. It's not high drama, so it's not like The Wire. But it's also not like The Office. It's not like trash. So I don't know. Anyway, it has sated me and it's super fun. I like it and I would recommend it to anyone that just sort of wants something to watch that, you know, that they can still kind of invest in. Like, I've been quite moved by episodes and...
Is it still on? Is it still airing or is it all done?
I think so. No, I think it's still going. So 6 seasons are on UK Netflix.
Wow.
But I think season 7's in the works. Maybe it might be airing in the States at the moment. I should have checked that before I started talking about it. But anyway, there's 6 seasons to get through, if nothing else. But yeah,
apparently
I like
the final episode, the final episode aired May 8th of 2016. So it finished this year.
Well, that might be maybe like season 7 or season 8, maybe. I can't imagine that would be on Netflix already. Yeah,
that was its season. That was its 7th season.
There you go.
And then there's going to do a spinoff called The Good Fight.
Oh, do you know who's in it?
Nope. I mean, I can look it up, but will that ruin things about the ending?
Oh, yeah, it might do, actually. You're right, because I'll know who survives and who doesn't. I mean, I've already
had a few... Wait, people die in this show?
Yeah, for sure.
Wow.
I mean, I've already had a few spoilers, but I don't really care because it's not really... I don't know. It's one of these kind of shows that... I mean, like, I feel like with so much TV, because I take TV much more seriously than I take films. So, like, I watch trashy films and really serious TV as a general rule. But... This one, I haven't been too bothered about spoilers and stuff because I kind of just enjoy watching it. Do you know what I mean? Like, I like spending time in the characters' company. The storylines are quite compelling. The actual cases week on week are quite interesting. Like, I learned
is she the lawyer?
Bitcoin. Yeah, she's the lawyer. Mm-hmm. She works for a firm called Lockhart Gardner. There was like an episode on Bitcoin. I learned tons about Bitcoin. They do some really interesting episodes about the judicial system in the States. And it's all quite interesting. But yeah, I recommend it. It's fun.
Cool. All right.
Also, Diane
Lockhart.
Do you
think I would like it?
No.
Okay.
Well, I think you won't have the time to watch it for what it is. I feel like knowing you and knowing your taste in TV and film and stuff, that you would be better spent investing that time elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, 7 seasons is like a huge...
It's a lot. Yeah, it's a big ask, you know.
And are these like network seasons that are like 24 episodes long?
Yeah, literally. Yeah, it's like 45-minute episodes, 24 episodes a season.
That's too much.
It's a really big commitment. But if you're into, like, because you don't like Castle, do you? And you don't like... Did you like Ally McBeal back in the day?
No,
probably
I don't think
not.
So.
Yeah. I think you'd have to be into these kinds of drama maybe to get something out of it, or be really, really into fashion, because the fashion is amazing. Like, such great fashion in it. Both of which I know aren't really your interests. But I think lots of people would like it.
Okay. Well, yeah. I'm glad you told me up front that I wouldn't like it.
Well, you know, I like to be honest with you, pal. That's the foundation of all good friendships.
It doesn't sound like I would be that into it, but no. Whatever. It's fine. Interesting characters and stuff. That's enough.
I mean, it's a shame because I think you would really like Alan Cumming and his character. He plays, he runs campaigns, basically. He's a campaign manager and he's very good in it. I mean, I'm a big fan of his anyway, but he's really, really good in this and he plays a great character and his subplot is really interesting, but it's probably not enough to, you know, engage with the whole show.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll check it out and do a few episodes. I mean... There's something nice about the shows where there's like, it's endless. You always have another one to put on because there's hundreds of episodes.
But sometimes it's nice to have those as 20-minute shows. Do you know what I mean?
I know, that's definitely, like, that's, yeah.
I'm always much more cautious about recommending a show that's this long because I'm like, it's a big commitment. And I think if you didn't like it within 5 or 6 episodes, don't bother. But even that is a lot. Like 5 or 6 episodes, we're talking like 5 hours.
Yeah.
It's a big commitment to ask from your friends.
Well, maybe I'll try it maybe. If I get bored and I am like not, sometimes you just are not interested in anything that you're normally interested in.
Sure.
You're like, I'm sick of all the things I regularly watch. I want something that I have no expectations about.
Yeah, totally. And actually, you know, Christmas is coming up. There's always some free time over Christmas when you're trying to avoid relatives and stuff. Not you specifically. Not you in the singular, you as a plural.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What about you? What have you been watching?
I have a bunch of stuff. I've started a bunch of other TV shows that I'm not going to talk about until I watch more of them. The only TV show I want to talk about is Westworld, which think I mentioned last time because we were a couple episodes in.
Yeah, briefly.
And it is now finished, and I think we should do a whole episode about it because it's a very interesting show and. It's kind of, I don't know, it's complicated and I don't necessarily feel like I'm obsessed with it and it's the best show ever, but at the same time, there's all this stuff that it does that I find very compelling and I kind of like have a lot of respect for their attention to detail and their like spinning this mystery that's unfolding across multiple episodes and, the performances are really awesome. Like Anthony Hopkins and Ed Harris are just like crushing it. Hopkins especially. Like I feel like I could just watch hours of his character having conversations with people because just the way he delivers lines is like so fascinating to watch, because he's such a like incredible actor, and he's playing this very complicated character that for most of the show you don't know what he, what his desires are and what his plans are, and he comes off kind of nice sometimes and you think maybe he has good intentions, and then other times he's very like threatening and sinister and you think he might be a villain. And Hopkins just plays him with like this really weird complexity, and it's
the he's kind got of thing a real that, talent for that though, hasn't he? He's got real form
yeah,
for
he
it
does.
That kind
I mean,
of creepy
like Hannibal.
Villain that you sort of like yeah,
yeah
enigmatic villains,
very like tons of depth to this character. And basically every conversation with him, you find him more and more fascinating. So it's worth watching just for like Hopkins doing, you know, this whole season of TV where he's one of the main characters.
Cool. And he's not really done anything major for a long time. He's done lots of like supporting roles and, but he's not done any kind of big meaty stuff for a while.
I know. And he's getting older. So I assume that like this, you know, must be a big deal for him to want to do a season of TV like this.
Well, especially because in the States, don't you have to commit to 7 seasons?
No, I don't think that
they... Is that not a rule anymore?
I don't think that's a rule anymore. I mean, that sounds like a network TV rule, not like a HBO rule.
Oh, yeah. Well, that happened... Because the reason I know about that, it happened with Star Trek, because Patrick Stewart signed up for one for Star Trek thinking that they would be like, oh, we'll just do one season and whatever. But it ended up being... Next Gen ended up being so popular that he ended up having to do all 7 seasons, like, because of the commitment.
Oh yeah, does he regret
his
that
contract? I don't think he does now, but he said at the time it was like, oh my god, I'm a really serious actor and now I'm signed up to do this science fiction show for 7 years. But anyway,
I mean I could see Hopkins being like, I'm not doing this for years, like
yeah
you know.
Well, he's probably got the star power anyway to say no,
right? So but it's, I think it's worth it. I mean, if you just love great performances in a TV show and complex characters that you find out more and more about them as the show goes on, it's worth it for that. And it's the Jonathan Nolan is the showrunner, and I think
where do we know him
wife?
From
he's Chris Nolan's brother, and he's been like a co-writer and co-producer on like the Dark Knight movies and Lisa Joy. It's Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy, and I think they might be married. Yeah.
Cool.
So it's being written by a couple together, and they're very, it's kind of like the thing that you want when you imagine like someone running a show, that like they get like full creative control and that they're not being constrained by a weekly release schedule or seasonal releasing or like a very strict budget. Like they did a lot of reshoots on this. I think they delayed releasing it by like months and months and months in order to go back and do reshoots.
Oh, good for them.
And it's not anything to do with like HBO's demands. It's purely them being like, we really want to get this right. And we're doing all this careful balancing of like this full story that will, you know, come out across the entire season, and so we want to go back and change things, and we realize we didn't do this right, so we want to go back and reshoot that. And plus the settings are, you know, I mean, part of it is like shooting a Western and part of it is like shooting a sci-fi show, and so it's like this incredible production, and it's really nice to see that kind of like freedom being given where like, yeah, sure, go ahead, you know, do extensive reshoots, go back and change things. I mean, it's pretty crazy. I think the level of like work and attention to detail and like creative freedom that HBO gave them. So it's also worth it for that. The actual like content and the plots, it's very like mystery. I think I said this last time, it kind of feels like a, you know, kind of Lost style. Like there's these central mysteries at the core of the show, and some of them are unfolding as the episodes occur, and some of them seem like they're going to be like the deeper mysteries that are, you know, for the whole season or for the whole entire series. And so if you like mysteries and you like figuring things out, it's very rewarding in that way.
Cool.
Like if you got really into Lost and loved looking at all the things like and trying to piece together what they could all mean, and then sometimes feeling like maybe these details don't mean anything and I'm just like reading into everything looking for, you know, some big twist or some big reveal and there actually isn't anything. Well, in the show, like it is, there is things, all of those details
really nice.
Are very intentional. They're like, it's kind of made for you to be super hyper aware of every single little detail in the background, the logos that are on doors, the way pictures are framed, and like every single thing has a meaning. And so that like analytical conspiracy theory, try to figure out what the mystery part of you can just go crazy with the show.
Great stuff.
Which is good. Yeah. So I don't know. There's a little bit of, there was times during the season where I felt like I was spending too much time as every time there was a conversation, every time somebody revealed something about their past, I immediately went into like this like problem solving analysis mode of being like, oh, how does this fit in with the existing theories? How does this undermine what I previously thought about this character and, you know, who they really are? Or does it confirm some other theory? And there was times where I started to worry that like it was hurting my enjoyment, like trying to figure things out so much rather than just kind of like sitting back and letting the creators of the show unfold things for me, like in their own time. Right. And you know, I would get on like Reddit and I would like read reviews to see what people were saying about like what did they think this moment meant. Did it confirm some other theory, or did it did it contradict something that people previously believed? But like that's like a fun fandom thing to do.
Yeah, totally.
But I think maybe this is the kind of show where like you have to do that the first time you watch it, and then the second time you watch it, then you can kind of just like relax and get more emotionally connected into what's happening because you don't have to figure out every single step of the thing.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad to hear that it didn't like go down the Lost route and then actually all of this setup is for nothing. That's really, that makes me want to watch it more. I'm so burned by Lost. Every time I think about it, I feel like this real ire like rising in me.
that has not happened so far. I mean, I don't know about the whole show, you know, as an entire series, but at least for season one, I think it was very, you got a lot of the stuff that they set up, there was payoff for. Everything, but like you kind of felt like they knew what they were doing.
Well, already they've beaten Lost because Lost started taking a nosedive about episode 7 of season 1.
So. Oh, I don't think that's true.
No, definitely. Yeah, we can talk about that in another episode. But for sure, like with Boone, that whole bit, I was like, after that, I was like, come on, what's happening? Okay, that's good to know.
So my biggest complaint, though, so everybody should
you
know this going
have
on,
one.
Is... Well, it feels like it's trying to be the like heir to Game of Thrones, maybe like the next big prestige show. And there's a little bit of the like edginess with violence and sex where you're like, is this necessary, or is this just you showing off like how far you're willing to push things?
For sure.
And it gets a little exhausting where you're like, yeah, okay, like we get it. You can do anything you want. Like, oh, there's a giant orgy scene with like 40 actors naked all doing sex acts on each other. And like, that's fine. I'm not a prude. I don't care about that. But like, there's a little bit of like, we get it, show. Like, we get how you can be edgy. We get that you can top Game of Thrones in like your level of sex that you can show.
Yeah.
And there's like some brutally violent scenes of, you know, people getting killed and people murdering each other. And I mean, part of the show is about like these AI, you know, synthetic people that are the hosts of Westworld, and they are always killed. Like they're there for the guests' amusement, for humans to come and to abuse and kill, and, you know, kind of the way that you would in any video game where there's non-player characters and you can, you know, you can go crazy and kill all of them and take over the town and do anything you want to them. And so, like, with one hand, the show is kind of like, oh, we're like shining a light on how people can indulge in these horrible things when they like think it's okay. And like, look how bad and violent humans can be sometimes. And like, you know, they take part in all these violent delights. One of the quotes from the show is, these violent delights have violent ends, which I think is from Shakespeare. Yeah.
Yep.
So they're like, on the one hand, it looks like it's supposed to be like criticizing that kind of stuff, and even maybe criticizing like TV shows in general and media in general of like, look at how, like, isn't there something fucked up about how much humans enjoy like death and causing suffering to people? But then at the other hand, you know, the show is also like benefiting from doing that. So like, it's kind of weird. Like, are you, is this a real criticism of it? Because you're also doing those things in the show to get people watching. And like, are you being preachy? Like, oh, look how bad it, like, you love watching Game of Thrones. You love seeing violence done against like women and weak people. And you love seeing like Ramsay be horrible, don't you? Well, like, what does that say about you? And you're like, yeah, I get what you're saying, but like, you're also doing that in order to make this show popular.
Sure.
So there's that like fine line of like, are you criticizing this or are you just like, you know, are you totally buying into it, but pretending that you're criticizing it in order to like be above it versus someone who's just like, we're just going to have a violent show. Like the show's going to be violent. That's it.
Yeah.
So that's a tough line to walk as well.
Yeah, it's a tough line to walk. I mean, I feel like maybe people are right that exposure desensitizes you to this kind of stuff eventually, because I'm much more able to cope with shows that are just needlessly sexual and needlessly violent now. And I feel like, I don't know, maybe like Game of Thrones just destroyed that part of me that's like repulsed because they were so bad at it.
Maybe.
But you know, I feel like everyone does it, like literally everybody is doing it now, all shows. And I find though that a lot of shows pare it down after season one. So like, I talk about Black Sails, I think, on this podcast quite a lot. First season of Black Sails is very Game of Thronesy, lots of violence, lots of sex, like really gratuitous, but then it gets really good and that becomes less of a kind of a shtick, and they start doing some quite interesting like relationship analysis and critiques about sexual identity and sexual orientation. It's really interesting, but the first season is really pulpy and then the rest of it kind of it raises itself up a bit. So maybe you'll see that with Westworld. Like, it's almost like there are a whole bunch, you can just see how these things work, even on a show that it sounds like the creators had a lot of creative control, but you can just see how people are like, there are no boobs in this first episode, they need to be boobs, otherwise we're not putting it, you know, whatever.
Right. Oh, there's expectations of like, what is a show on HBO like, and it has to have violence and it has to have sex and it has to be edgy and gritty. It, like, so
they're trying to be the Sopranos or they're trying to be Game of Thrones, so it's either super sexy or super violent. Like, it's one or the other. They're the two golden masts.
Maybe that'll happen, but I mean, like I said, it also might be like, it is more interesting a lot of times what they're showing than just straight like violence.
Good.
Like, there is some critique there, which makes it a little bit more interesting. Like, what are they trying to show here with this? But there's also other times where, like, there are eye-rolly moments where you're like, this is just too much. Like, this is so over the top. Mm. Like, why do we have to see this, like, you know, gross, horrible thing being done to somebody that, okay, fine, technically they're, like, a robot, but still, it's, you know, the imagery of somebody doing this to a person. But, I mean, besides, you know, besides that stuff, I think it's highly recommended as a...
Cool.
As a show with great performances and as like a little puzzle box to uncover as it unfolds. And I think, I hope this is, you know, not too spoiler or anything, but like the end of season one definitely makes you excited for more of the show.
Cool.
And it is very much like, I don't know where the show is going to go. Like, this show could go anywhere at this point. And it's not like, it doesn't feel kind of like it's going to be this predictable stasis over every episode. Like, now we kind of know what the show is, and this is just going to continue over and over again for the next however many seasons. It feels like the next season could be like a sequel movie, which goes in a totally different direction than you expect and is not just like, you know, the same old stuff happening.
Cool.
The way that you would expect. I mean, you don't know that for sure, but it definitely ends with that possibility that, like, what you've seen during season one is not the status quo that is going to continue for the rest of the series. Like, and I think even the creators, I think Lisa Joy and Jonathan Nolan said that, like, you can view season one as a pilot for the rest of the show.
Well, also, that's kind of built into the story in itself, right? Because they're creating they're creating worlds that what are they called in the show?
Guests and
like
hosts.
They literally go into. So if they've got ultimate control of AI and they've got space, they can make it any setting they want, right, as well. So
yeah, and
they could change it up.
There's a lot of mysteries that I don't want to reveal about, like, what the nature is of the world.
Mm.
Like, the outside world outside of this park.
Sure.
And So there's tons of stuff that, like, then the show kind of, the season kind of ended with, like, we could go in a number of different directions, and pretty much all of them could be vastly different from season one. And, like, you know, I guess we'll see. It's not going to, season two is not going to come out for, like, over a year. I think it's not going to be out until 2018.
Gosh, that is a long time.
Yeah, and again, the creator said, like, you know, we don't have to follow the rules. There's no seasons any, like, there's no, like, you know, scheduled seasons, like,
yeah,
we're just gonna work on the story and film it and then do reshoots if we need to, and so, like, it'll be done when it's done, which is very reassuring, despite, like, obviously as soon as it, you know, you want to watch more of it, but it's, you know, reassuring that, like, you know, when the next one comes out, like, it'll be good.
Yeah, it'll be well crafted, well, one hopes. Okay, that sounds cool. I'm glad that it didn't let you down. I was worried when we were last talking and you compared it to Lost. I was like, oh boy, let's hope that that doesn't happen. So I'm glad it didn't.
So far it hasn't.
Hooray.
I have movies real quick too. I want to recommend movies.
We also need to talk about the big Marvel movie that came out.
Doctor Strange. Marvel.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to talk about. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Oh my God. You're recommending it? Dude.
Yeah, I think so.
Boy.
I mean, okay. I'm saying I saw it and I enjoyed it a lot.
Talk about it with spoilers because it's been out long enough.
Okay. Well, do you want to tell me why you didn't like it then? And then I'll give my defense of it, I guess.
I don't like Benedict Cumberbatch.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of him either.
That is a problem in and of itself. I think, as usual, it suffered from what Marvel always suffers from, which is really shit villains. And I say that as Mads Mikkelsen's biggest fan. Like, yeah,
we're mad about Mads.
Mad about Mads on this podcast, as everyone knows. I think that it's the same shtick that Marvel always do, where they just they have a version of the superhero's powers against the superhero and they're equally matched and it's all rubbish.
Yeah. And it's going to destroy the whole world, and there's some device that's going to be activated to, like, wipe out the planet. And
then they did my least favorite thing in science fiction, where they used a time paradox to win. It's literally my least favorite thing. Like, I'm so miserable talking about it because it is my least favorite trope in science fiction. And people use it so heavily, and they used it in this, and that was super annoying.
Yeah, I was more... Okay, so this is... I liked that, without giving too much away, I liked that the problem wasn't solved with CGI punching. He did not physically overpower the opponent or punch them so hard. You know, it wasn't like in these other movies where it's like you watch the superhero and the villain just punch each other back and forth until one of them finally gets really mad and punches really hard, and then that ends the fight. It was like kind of like a clever using my mind and the things that I learned earlier in this movie to kind of like tricky negotiate a victory.
Sure.
So I appreciated that.
Okay. It definitely felt different to other Marvel stuff. I don't know how they're going to get it into the world, because the problem with Doctor Strange is that his powers are so extensive that, it's like, oh, the Chitauri are attacking, and he's like, clicks his fingers, now they're not attacking anymore. You know, so how do you keep the peril when Doctor Strange is as powerful as he is?
Well,
so
I mean, you don't really know how powerful he is.
Well, I'm from the comics and stuff, but
from
everything, like even if it wasn't made explicit in this movie, he can warp time and he can warp reality. He can bend and he can create portals, you know, like he has complete control over matter on the earth. So he'll just, you know, I feel like it's going to completely imbalance their powers unless they introduce the space stuff, which I guess they're going to do with Guardians and Thor.
I feel weirdly not worried about that for some reason. I don't know why. But I think part of it was they introduced him as being like kind of a noob. Like, he used a really powerful device to win, but they made it very clear, I thought, in the movie that, like, there's going to be serious consequences for that. And that is against, like, the rules. Like, you're not supposed to mess with the natural order of things. You're not supposed to mess with time and space in that way.
Well, that's what's set off Chiwetel Ejiofor's character.
Right.
What's his character called? Begins with an M.
It was, Frick, like Modo or something. I can't remember.
I can't remember what his name is. He was good, as usual. He was really channeling.
He was like the... Yeah, the operative from Serenity.
Yeah. I was thinking that as well. He was seriously channeling the same character, which I loved because he was fantastic in Serenity. I loved him in that movie. I was just going to say, I was concerned about the casting of Tilda Swinton in the first place, and I thought she was very underwhelming in it.
They should have given her more to do. They underused her, I think. But yeah, okay. So about the powers thing, I mean, the thing that he used that was really powerful in order to win was an Infinity Stone, which is like they're building that up. That's the whole big thing, is like the Infinity Stones and Thanos. So like without those things, I feel like he's not that powerful. All he could do is like make the little portals and stuff. He wasn't even at like Tilda level of, you know, being able manipulate the mirror world. And they also made it really clear, I think, in the movie, or maybe they didn't make it really clear, but it was clear to me that like they can't do those things in the real world. Like they can put someone into a different dimension where it's like a sandbox and they can play in that dimension, but they can't do those things in like the real world. But that was the power that the bad guy in the movie basically had, was like all these like reality time warping things. I don't have to just do them in the mirror dimension. I can do them in the real world. So I thought they kind of like boxed him in enough that he's not like overwhelmingly powerful.
But then by establishing that that is possible, the only conclusion that I can make is that that is the next level for Doctor Strange in his development in his next movie.
Yeah, I mean, I think at some point it's probably going to get more and more fantastic. Like, how can you keep going with him in his direction and the other superheroes? And like at some point, the power levels are so divergent.
I think so. I don't read Doctor Strange, but from speaking to friends that have read it, I think it's the way they cope with it in the comics is that Doctor Strange chooses when to act.
So he's just always distracted by like metaphysical enemies and
he basically would not get involved with the Chitauri. Like he's at a different level, and so he'll only engage
with things
when
that threaten space time.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. That's how they kind of the wall between them, that's how they build it, by it.
Well, maybe that's what they'll do. Choice. And then in Avengers it'll be Thanos attacking and he wants the Infinity Gems, and so that's enough to get Doctor Strange involved.
Yeah, I can't wait for Cap to shout at him for being selfish. That's going to be the greatest scene of all time. Can't wait.
I'm kind of excited. I don't want to start talking about Avengers, the next Avengers movie now, but I'm pretty impressed that like this has been 10 years of Marvel building this up, and now we're going to have like the big bad battle finally.
Well, we've got Ragnarok as well before then, right?
Oh, that's true.
And that's going to have some cross stuff in it as well. They've just started filming. They started filming in October Infinity Wars Part 1. So I think it's going to be great. I mean, as everyone who listens to this podcast knows, I'm a big fan of the MCU. I was very underwhelmed by Doctor Strange. However, I recognize that I went in there thinking I didn't agree with the casting choices, and I also hate Benedict Cumberbatch. So I kind of went in there knowing that I would be probably not its biggest fan. I also thought that they really underused Rachel McAdams. Like, why was she even in it? She's such a talented actress and she barely did anything, and it was just frustrating. I'm just like, come on, man.
I think the like fight scenes and use of powers was so unique and interesting to me that it kind of like overpowered my skeptic. Like, I went in being kind of like, this is, you know, people are saying this is good and not like a typical Marvel movie, but like, how good is it really going to be? And then, I mean, this is like the least lazy use of CGI I've seen in years, like since Inception or something, where like you're finally like, yes, CGI being used for something that you couldn't possibly do with practical effects. Like, this isn't, they're not CGIing blood onto somebody or like just CGIing a person kicking. Because it's easier to do that than have, you know, whatever, some stunt person do it.
Yeah.
And this is like totally manipulation of the world and the environment in like a crazy, trippy, like, you know, almost like psychedelic way. And this could only be done with computers. And I thought it was like
into the visuals. And I know everyone's talked about how good they were. And there's this one scene, right, where he like goes through multiple dimensions and his hands grow hands and it's all very whatever. But I was like, I think maybe it's because I expected them to be really, really good. And they showed so much of their hand in the trailer. It's like, just stop doing trailers that show you everything and show you all the big budget shots.
Like, I don't know if I even watched the trailer. Yeah, I think I might not have even seen the trailer.
Well, I think, unfortunately, I did see it because I watch everything that Mads Mikkelsen's in, including trailers. But, like, he you know, the bit where he kind of is opening up a portal and you've got, like, it's almost hexagons that are showing the exact same thing and they're all twisting in opposite. Mm-hmm. It's a stunning shot. It's so pretty to look at. But I'd already seen it, so it wasn't as impactful on me, I guess.
Yeah, I can see that. Mm. I mean, right from the very opening with Tilda Swinton, when she like chases them into, you don't realize it at the time, but it is the mirror dimension. And then she's just like, I'm going to turn the whole world on its side and everything is going to become like a machine that works for me to destroy you and your men. And I was just like, awesome, where like these gears are coming up out of like the shapes of the buildings. And like, I don't know, I was very into that. And just even simple stuff like, the way they made the portals, it looked like when you spin around, there's like these filaments or something that you can light on fire. Yes. Or maybe it's like copper or something and you spin it and it gives off all those sparks.
Yes, pretty.
And maybe they just did that with practical effects too. But like that was just such a simple effect of like this thing spinning, throwing off sparks. And they used that to make portals. And I thought that looked great. And yeah, I don't know. I also liked the not having Cumberbatch's character, not having Doctor Strange be good at things, that he was like, they set him up as like, okay, whatever, he's super brilliant and smart and cocky, but like he's has a disability and he kind of sucks at doing stuff, and he's fighting like people that are really good at it. And so there was all these like nice, I thought, moments where he's improvising and he's fighting with whatever tools he has, and they're also funny moments, like the cape is helping him. And he's just, you know, he's picking up things he doesn't know what they do and using them to threaten people and then just hitting them on the head with it. And I thought there was a lot of like combat pragmatism that I thought was funny and cute and kind of charming and way better than just having him be like, you know, like Superman, like I'm just super powerful and fighting you is easy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll give you that, but I didn't find any of it charming. For confirmation, okay.
Find the cape charming?
No, it's associated with the least charming person on the planet. So,
well, poor Cumberbatch.
No, I really hate him, and I hate Eddie Redmayne as well. The two of them, I call them the otter and the weasel. I hate them. Right.
I guess Cumberbatch is definitely the otter.
Yeah, he's the otter, and he's the weasel. He's like really weaselly. I just hate both of them. Sorry. Loads of people love them, but I really don't like them.
I'm neutral. I'm like tepid on both of them.
That's good times. Okay, I'm like 3, you're like 4 out of 5 for Doctor Strange.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. That's fine. I'm like less enthusiastic than you are for once. That's good. It gives some balance to our podcast.
I mean, don't go in thinking it's like amazing movie, but it was just like, it was different enough from the other Marvel movies that I found it worth going. And it made me wish I'd actually seen it in 3D. And I never wish I'd seen movies in 3D. But when I got out of it and I talked to other people, they were like, oh, in 3D, those scenes where they're like bending the worlds are even more trippy. And I was like, actually, I kind of wish I'd seen that in 3D.
Maybe a little inebriated would be interesting as well.
Yeah, I'm sure that would help. Okay, one more movie recommendation. I know it's been so long until our main topic.
That's okay.
I saw Arrival in theaters with Amy Adams. I really liked it a lot. If you like Contact or kind of like talky sci-fi movies that are, you know, don't have a lot of CGI punching or action or anything like that, or if you liked Interstellar or Contact, I feel like you would like Arrival. I don't think we should really talk about it that much because a lot of it is like, yeah. And part of the fun of that movie is like discovering what's going on. And, but it had great design. The aesthetic of that movie was awesome. So many times you've seen alien related things, alien languages or alien ships or aliens themselves. And you're like, God, this is like, you know, we've seen it so many times. It's nice when you see like kind of a new, interesting take that doesn't feel like it's trying too hard, but also feels like this is cool. Like,
yeah,
I was into the aesthetic.
I went in with really low expectations because I feel like the trailer did it a real disservice. Like the trailer made it seem really clunky and I didn't feel like it was clunky at all, actually. It did one thing that I didn't like, but I won't talk about it because of spoilers. But okay. In general, I was really into it. I liked it from like the kind of sociolinguistic angle. I thought it was very cool. She gave a fantastic performance as always. And I didn't even hate Jeremy Renner in it. So that was good as well.
I think they might have maybe had a hard time knowing how to market it. Like, yeah, is this an action-y movie? Is it like Independence Day, or is it like, I don't know. And
they marketed Interstellar really well though, and it's sort of similar to Interstellar.
Yeah, yeah. In but Interstellar, they did like a like lingering on like beautiful shots and weird moments thing. I think a lot in the trailers, and this was like they tried to make it seem like, oh, this is very intense and dramatic, and there is some action. And I don't know, it's a very nice movie, and it has like a heart to it, and it's kind of like what good sci-fi is, where it's, you know, it's humane and it's supposed to be about people and what's rooted. Wrong with humans and
rooted in human relationships. And I thought the way they looked at how the world would respond was very interesting and realistic as well, which I liked.
Yeah.
Because like it. Otherwise it's like, okay, like Independence Day, and it's like they've got that ridiculous shot where they go to the British Air Force, and then they're like, oh, the Americans are going to do it. And they're like, oh, about bloody time that they sorted it out. And it's like, what the hell is happening? Like, Britain would have their own thing going on. Surely all the countries would have their own response to the alien invasion.
Oh, everyone would check with America.
Everyone would check in with the States. No, but you know what I mean? I thought like the planet's response was interesting. Anyway. Spoilers.
Yeah. That's it. I have other things to say too, but they're also spoilers. But go see it if you're into those kind of, you know, smart talky sci-fi movies.
Sorry.
What?
That description would really put me off seeing it.
I feel like people know that.
Smart talky sci-fi? No, like, it's like...
Contact is like, it's smart and it's talky and there's a lot of like...
Sci-fi?
But there's not like, you know, there's not like space battles or... Yeah.
It's not Star Wars.
Yeah, it's not like Star Trek sci-fi or Star Wars sci-fi. It's like, I mean, this is the kind of thing that like you would think, this would be like a Star Trek episode of the TV, of the TV show. Like,
it would, yeah.
The kind of like ethical dilemma, figuring out what's going on, like, and how, and then, you know, all of this stuff kind of like reflecting on humanity and how humans are and our worst impulses versus our best impulses. And
I mean, this is sci-fi, whereas like Star Wars is like space opera. Like, it's a little different.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's like fantasy.
Yeah.
Fantasy in space.
Cool.
Okay. I know that you have a extremely high level kind of philosophical, analytical film theory topic for this week. So we should get to it.
I'm like a really serious film person. I don't know if you've picked up on that. I really take things very seriously. I do. Our main topic. So I thought we would talk about this because, first of all, it's easy for me to talk about and I didn't have to prepare a lot for it. And secondly, because I feel like this, of all the things, all the outrageous things that I say, all the hyperbolic comments that I make in life when I'm talking about movies and when I'm talking to people, this is the thing that I get the most criticism for and the most like, what the fuck are you even talking about, Katie, responses. So that's why I thought we would talk about this topic.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want me to introduce the topic?
Yeah, introduce the topic.
So I have a theory that Tom Cruise is actually the best actor of his generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I know, I'm aware
you
of
know,
that.
You
I'm
know
aware
this.
That you believe that.
Do you remember? I'm aware you believe it. Do you remember what your first response was when you found out that I was an enormous Tom Cruise fan?
Why? Maybe
repulsion. Yeah.
No, I'm not repulsed, but I mean, that's not the hill that I would go to die on.
Yeah. It's really interesting because, so I would just, for the record, I'm not talking about Tom Cruise as a person because who even knows what's happening there? Like, he seems very nice in interviews, but then you see these Scientology videos, the whole thing is very disturbing. So this is definitely not a defense of his character, but it is definitely a defense of his work. I find him to be, he's my favorite actor, bar none. He really is. I think I'm going to go on to talk about why, but this is
this
not,
one of those things where if I ask you who your favorite actor is in like two episodes from now, you'll have a totally different answer?
Probably.
Or is this like real, like your real actual, this will always be true, your favorite actor?
I feel like it took me a really long time to admit to it, but I feel like I have always been such a massive Tom Cruise fan, and you know, and because of trying to be cool and hipster and whatever, I like tried to deny it for a really long time. I can appreciate, like, so I love Mads Mikkelsen, and I love, you know, the, like, Daniel Day-Lewis, fantastic, but I think if he isn't, he's definitely one of my favorites. If he isn't the best, he's definitely underrated. Okay, I will compromise with incredibly underrated. But no, I think when people ask me, most of the time I will reply that Tom Cruise is my favorite actor. Most of the time, definitely. Which is, you know, pretty strong for me because I'm quite an inconsistent person. I don't know if people have picked up on that on the podcast. But, you know, I go through phases of obsession. But yeah, I've liked him ever since I first saw Top Gun when I was like a teenager, and it's always been like on the back burner. I've not really wanted to talk about it a lot because I was always so embarrassed, I think, or thought that it was uncool that I loved him. But now I'm like, fuck you, he's amazing. And this is going to be my defense of him, this conversation.
Okay, so who are you defending him from? Like the general movie going public or like critics or... I feel like just the whole world.
I feel like the whole world. Like, because basically, as I said, whenever I say this to anybody, they like laugh. Like, their instinct is to think that I am, because I'm such a clown, that I'm joking when I'm actually being extremely serious. Or when I say, oh, I love Tom in this, they think I mean Tom Hardy. That's another thing that I get quite a lot. And, you know, I think people really genuinely think that I'm joking. So that's why I'm going to talk about it today, because I'm not joking. But also, whenever you see like lists of like the best actors and stuff, it's always our boy Leonardo DiCaprio and like Daniel Day-Lewis and obviously De Niro and Pacino and Dustin Hoffman. I feel like he never gets a look in, you know. Sometimes Brad Pitt does, and I would argue his career is much better than Brad Pitt's. Brad Pitt is very inconsistent. So it's also against like critics in general. He's never won an Academy Award, not that that really matters because who gives a shit about awards. But, you know, like there's a real kind of underappreciation for him from both kind of casual fans like me and also like hardcore critics and the media in general, I think. I don't think I've ever seen a spread that says, you know, that he's the finest actor of his generation. He often gets like billed as, you know, the best action star or something because of his work in action movies. But I feel like he's actually way more talented than people give him credit for.
So why is he more talented? Like, do you think people are just biased against him?
Yeah, I think it's one of these interesting phenomenons. Phenomena? How do we say this word?
Phenomena.
Oh, it sounds like Zig Ziglar. So I'm going to, like, in my head, that's how I'm going to pronounce it from now. Phenomena. Okay, so that's the Spice Girls reference for anyone too young to remember the Spice Girls. What was I saying? Phenomenon. Oh yeah, I think it's this thing to do with like 2K16. We have access to everything about celebrities now. It's absolutely bonkers. We have such unmitigated access to their lives, and he has done some very questionable / interesting / bizarre things in public eye and not in the public eye that have been reported on, such as, like, I think Louis Theroux just done a thing on Scientology and he's in a video in Scientology being creepy and staring at the screen. And I think so often people can't help but conflate the two, which we should talk about a little later on, because I think it comes into that conversation about whether or not you can ever separate artists from art, and how one of them always seems to feed into the other. But I think he very much is a victim of the fact that he as an individual has a very poor reputation. And I feel like that seems to I think people are unconsciously biased against him. They think he's a schmuck, and so they don't like his work.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I think I'm trying to think of like what is the public perception of Tom Cruise? I feel like it's like he's like a decent actor, TV star, but like kind of a weirdo.
Yeah, I think everyone thinks that he's an average weirdo.
Yeah. He's like a handsome TV star, but he's like a weirdo. He was, you know, there's stories about him like being really controlling of like Katie Holmes. And then there's all the Scientology stuff and him jumping up and down on the couch and on Oprah. And everyone just like, he's just kind of like a bizarre person who is, you know, is handsome looking and is an okay actor.
Yeah. He sent kind of this very average 3-star actor who's, kind of his personality is eccentric and potentially just an oddball.
But why is he better than that perception?
He's better. So I'm going to talk about some of his best roles. Some of the reasons that I think that Tom Cruise is amazing. So first of all, I think we need to talk about longevity. So he, as we discussed previously, Top Gun, he's in his 4th decade of acting, right? Which is a really long time. And I think actually people don't necessarily think about him having this wealth of acting under his belt, because I think people forget about some of the films that he's been in, because his like current work is so focused in actions and thrillers that people forget about all these other roles that he's undertaken throughout his career. So he's got some real longevity there, but he's also, as part of that longevity, he's got real variety in his performance. I think part of the issue is that when people think about Tom Cruise, they think of him as an action star. But in reality, he's done absolutely everything. If you go on his, like, even if you just go on his filmography, the different genres of movies, he's done everything from like horror to science fiction. He's done some small dramas.
What horror has he been in?
He was in, I'm going to talk about it later, Interview with the Vampire.
Oh, okay.
He played Lestat, which is one of his best roles. It's so underrated. It's kind of, so he plays the vampire Lestat, and he is kind of creepy and funny and very enigmatic, and he carries that performance. He's got some real caliber in there with him, because he's up against Brad Pitt. He's got Antonio Banderas is in it. Kirsten Dunst in her best ever role when she's a 12-year-old. Absolutely amazing. Yeah, she's a kid. She's a little girl. And who else in it? Christian Slater is in it, you know. But he is outstanding in that film. He carries the whole movie. It could have been terrible without him, actually. So he's done horror, he's done some small dramas. So like my favorite probably is Magnolia. I don't know if you ever saw that.
I don't think I saw it, but I know of it.
Yeah, it's Paul Thomas Anderson, who is the only hipster director that I actually like. He's done so many good films. He did Boogie Nights and he did There Will Be Blood. And he's my exception to the rule that I don't like hipster nonsense. But he's in Magnolia. He plays a guy called Frank Mackey. And he is a motivational speaker. But what he basically is he's a guy that teaches people to be a pickup artist. And he's like really kind of, he steals every scene that he has in that film, and he's really, his performance is really powerful. It's really strong. It's like comic and also kind of creepy. And then he's like, basically his family are dying and he has to like help people, and he's got all this internal drama. And it's like, I feel like if anyone else did that role, they would be heavily associated with that role when people talked about it. And yet no one ever seems to remember it. Whenever I bring it up, they're like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, this was like a really career defining role. Because he carried that whole, what is a good movie with an incredible ensemble cast. You know, it's got Philip Seymour Hoffman in it. It's got Julianne Moore in it. It's an amazing movie. And he is the standout star in that film, which is bonkers, right? Because if people were to say who's the better actor between Philip Seymour Hoffman and Tom Cruise, I feel like everyone would plump for Philip Seymour Hoffman. Don't get me wrong, I think he's a fine actor, but he's what I'm trying to say is that Tom Cruise is of that caliber as well. and then he's done things like Rain Man. He did Valkyrie, which is a historical drama. He did.
Yeah, but that's kind of like an action movie too.
Yeah, it's action-y, but it's like, it's not, you know, the Jason Statham action movie. You know, it's not like big guns and modern spy stuff, like, which is what we kind of heavily associate with action. It is a historical action film. It's for people that don't know about Valkyrie, it's about an assassination attempt against Hitler. And he's the lead in that, and he's fantastic in
Doesn't he only have one arm in that, too? I remember thinking that was kind of interesting.
But, yeah, I mean, That's what I'm talking about. Like, there's some real variety in all his performances and in the types of movies that he does. One of the things that I think is really impressive about him as an actor is that he is not hemmed in and he is not typecast. I think he seems to, because he's so rich and he can do what he wants and he produces a lot of his own films and stuff, he can kind of do what he wants. And he definitely seems to have an interest in action and sci-fi. But if you look at the longevity of his career, you know, Jerry Maguire, that's like a romantic comedy sports drama. It's like a totally different genre. And he got, you know, it's not one of my favourite films of his, although I always recommend it to people that haven't seen it just because it's him in a very different light. But, you know, he got nominated for an Academy Award for that movie. And he won the Golden Globe for it. You know, it's some stellar work there.
Okay, so let me...
I can keep going, but I'm not going to. Go on, ask me some questions. Well,
I mean, so I haven't seen, like... I haven't seen Vanilla Sky in years. I haven't seen Jerry Maguire in years. I don't think I've ever seen Magnolia or Eyes Wide Shut. So, like, I know he's done that stuff, but I think one of the things, like, that I feel about him, and I assume that part of the reason why other people, like, have feelings from him that are highly influenced by like the stuff in his personal life is a lot of the movies he's in, he's just doing that like big movie thing where he's just Tom Cruise.
Those
roles you're talking about might be kind of exceptions to it, but in a lot of the movies I see, like the Mission Impossible movies and I don't know, the Jack Reacher movies and Oblivion and all the stuff that I've seen him, War of the Worlds and Minority Report, like he just came off like he's just Tom Cruise. He's not like deep into some other character. I think Edge of Tomorrow, he put a kind of interesting spin on it where he kind of presented himself as like a douchebag and like a coward. And I really liked him in Edge of Tomorrow because I thought, oh, finally Tom Cruise is not presenting himself as being like the awesome hero. And who's just Tom Cruise. He's like this weird character that's kind of a coward and has to, you know, find his courage throughout the course of the movie.
Sure.
But I think that is an exception to that. Like, as far as the action movies are concerned, it's kind of like Bruce Willis. Like, nobody thinks Bruce Willis is one of the best actors in the world. And everybody feels like in the majority of the movies he does, he's just being Bruce Willis.
I definitely agree with that about Bruce Willis. And I think actually that this is part of what I'm talking about. I'm trying to like combat these perceptions that Tom Cruise has this, that he's quite linear in his performance and his portrayal, because I see real variety, because I watch so many Tom Cruise movies as well. Like, I see real variety in his different performances. And I mean, I would counter as well that, like, to an extent, all actors have that, where Pacino always plays a certain style and De Niro and
yeah, once
DiCaprio,
you hit a certain level of, you know, like notoriety,
yeah,
almost becomes like you're just playing yourself.
Yeah, and I think as well there is an element even at that high level of being typecast where they're like they want you to Al Pacino this film, they want you to bring DiCaprio to this movie,
right.
And
but nobody is praising them anymore for being the best actors in the world. Like, maybe DiCaprio they are, but I feel like Pacino and De Niro, they're like, oh, in their early movies, they were like some of the best actors ever. And now when you see them, they're just being Pacino and De Niro.
Well, I've got this argument as a later counter as well, because like what Tom Cruise hasn't done, which a lot of his peers have done, is done a Meet the Fockers or done a, you know, these stupid fucking movies that are absolute bollocks,
like,
where they're
Night
phoning
and
it
Day.
In. Well, that, I don't know if that is as bad as everyone makes out that it is. I think that was just kind of like a fun caper, but he's definitely, I mean, I'm going a bit ahead of myself here, but he's definitely committed to that film. I don't think that Tom Cruise ever makes a film that he thinks this is a filler. This is filler for my, you know, to pad out my pension or whatever. I feel like whenever he talks about movies that he's in, he's very serious. Like, and he, if you watch any interviews of him recently, which talking about Jack Reacher, he's totally committed to bringing Jack Reacher, which is, you know, like Pulp Fiction, but he's totally committed to bringing it to life. And I watched it because I am a committed fan and I will watch anything that he is in. But he, that film, it totally surprised me because I thought it was going to be really crap, blockbuster, rubbish action thriller stuff, right? You know, really two-star movie. But actually, it had the tone and pace and gravitas of like an indie drama. It was so interesting to see a film of that genre shot in a way which was totally different to how I expected it. I expected it to be very Jason Statham or you know, whatever that, there's the equivalent, right, like Jack Ryan that stars Chris Pine or whatever.
What about Jack Reacher 2?
The only Chris not to make it into the Holy Trinity. I've not managed to see Jack Reacher 2 because it was only out in cinemas for 2 weeks. Devastating. But I will watch it over Christmas. But there's definitely, to my mind, even in these films that should be terrible, he doesn't Nicolas Cage it. Do you know what I mean? He still brings a really strong performance to it. And whereas Nicolas Cage has been phoning it in for the last decade, I mean, but all of the films that he's in are appalling. Like, Tom Cruise has not fallen into that. He's not fallen into the Cage
because he's
gap.
So, like, self-serious. He's so, like, isn't that it part of the thing that people don't like about him? Is, like, he thinks he's awesome and he takes himself super seriously?
I don't know if he does think he's awesome in terms of, like, he's quite, So, okay, we should talk about him and the stunts, right? Because I think the stunts is a really good example of his commitment to the work. So, like, when Daniel Day-Lewis fucking goes off and lives hand to mouth for 6 months, everyone's like, oh my God, Daniel Day-Lewis, you're so method. Oh, you're so impressive. You're such a serious human being. But then when Tom Cruise, like, learns to hold his breath underwater for 6 minutes so that he could do that amazing scene in Rogue Nation, all of a sudden everyone's like, oh, Tom Cruise is so serious and he's so, like, whatever, eccentric. And I'm like, I don't understand why there seems to be these two separate rules. Like, everyone's like, yourself included, Moya, talking about DiCaprio and, oh my God, he put up with all that cold and, like, all that frost on his face is real. Oh, The Revenant's amazing. When actually it's like Tom Cruise hanging out of a plane, you know, to do the stunt again in Rogue Nation. Everyone's like, oh, Tom Cruise is such an idiot. Why is he hanging out of a plane and not getting a stunt guy to do it for him? You know, and he did that incredible, one of my favorite stunts of all time, when he climbed the tallest building in Dubai Flipping Hell, I can't remember what it's called. Ghost Protocol.
Ghost Protocol.
Sorry. It's like my favorite film. How could I not remember it? Anyway, in Ghost Protocol, and he does that stunt. And, you know, the media, people slam him for it. They're like, Tom Cruise is so dumb. Why doesn't he just let stunt
Did he
actually?
Wait, what do you mean? He actually climbed the tallest building in Dubai?
Yeah.
He was on.
Yeah. He scaled it to do those shots.
True?
That's him hanging out of it. Yeah. Obviously, they've definitely, he didn't, you know, he wasn't hanging by his foot. He's definitely had a safety harness that they've digitized in some way. But yet, Tom Cruise, ever since Mission Impossible 2, has done nearly all his own stunts. Like, he is so committed to producing an authentic performance, which is why Mission Impossible movies, when you watch them, for me at least, the stunts and the action sequences are much more enjoyable because they can do some really lingering shots on face and stuff because they're not using a double. He literally was hanging out of the side of a plane when they were doing the Rogue Nation opening shot. That's all him. And so I don't understand why he can be criticized for his commitment. Like, for Jack, no, it wasn't Jack Reacher, it was Rogue Nation. He learned to hold his breath underwater for 6 minutes so that he could do this scene where he has to dive really deep. You know, I don't understand why that can be criticized in him, but when we look at, I'm picking on Daniel Day-Lewis because he comes to mind whenever I think of method acting, when people are like, Daniel Day-Lewis learned how to use Victorian butcher's knives to play Bill the Butcher in Gangs of New York, it's like, oh, that's commitment to his craft. You know, he's dedicated as a dedicated actor. He wanted to produce an authentic performance. I don't understand why there's that dichotomy in both their approaches, which to me are the same.
That might be unfair. Yeah, that might be totally unfair. Mm.
But this is a weird phenomenon, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's what you're saying. I think it's like something about his personality. It's kind of like, you know, Jared Leto doing those things, and everyone like eye rolls and they're like, okay, yeah, you're so method, like get a life.
Yeah, but the problem with Jared Leto is that what he was doing just isn't method. First of all, he's trying to be the Joker. That's not a real person. But also, like, he does gross things. Like, the reason that I was very critical of his method approach, because he was sending bullets to people and he was giving people
condoms and stuff.
And I'm like, that is just disgusting behavior. Whereas, you know, teaching yourself to hold your breath underwater for 6 minutes, that doesn't impact anyone except for yourself. You know what I mean?
Okay,
there's
so,
something kind of valuable there.
So I'll give you the, he's more of like a professional, real, dedicated, hardworking actor than people give him credit for.
I think so.
But like, does that make, why is he the best actor in the world then?
Well, I think part of it is to do with, so longevity is definitely part of it. I think variety in performance, a couple of other performances that I will mention in light of trying to kind of illuminate the variety in his performance. Have you ever seen the movie Collateral, directed by Michael
Mann? I have seen that. Yeah, I remember that.
And he's fantastic.
Years ago. And he had like white hair in it or something.
Yeah, he's like, he did the whole Salt and Pepper, his hottest look, by the way. He did the whole Salt and Pepper. It's him and Jamie Foxx. 90% of that movie is him talking to Jamie Foxx in a cab. And that movie is tense and compelling the whole way through. And that is a very different, understated side to Tom Cruise. That is not the Ethan
Hunt.
You know, big bombastic sort of approach that we see in Mission Impossible. You know, there's some, again, there's some real variety in his performances and what he's delivering for the audience. And Magnolia, again, is completely different to both of those performances. Like, I think part of the issue is that he's pegged as this action star when actually he has much more range.
But that's definitely
that.
The majority of the movies he's done.
Like, I think it's the majority of the movies he's done recently, but if you look at his entire catalogue, it's not.
Maybe. I like him in A Few Good Men.
Yeah,
I remember that movie. I don't know.
Born on the 4th of July, he got the Oscar nod for that, and he got a Golden Globe for that as well. He also got a Golden Globe and an Oscar nod for Magnolia. I think recently he definitely has stuck to, I mean, Mission Impossible. He clearly loves doing those movies. Like, he's clearly having a great time. So why not? Like, there's something kind of lovely about the fact that you could be an actor for 35 years and not become jaded with the art form at all and still want to do, you know, deliver.
Well, because he's an immortal and is drinking some kind of secret Scientology serum so he doesn't age.
He's literally like, when he did that stunt, he was 50, and I'm like, that in itself is impressive. But anyway, but I think also, even though he might be doing movies, you know, action films, which maybe, I mean, this is a completely different discussion. Maybe, you know, action films are definitely in what we call the ghetto, right? Where they're like not seen as high art.
Not sufficiently artful enough.
Yeah. But I think even within those films, as I said, Jack Reacher, it was a very different type of movie to what, you know, the poster would suggest. But if we talk about The Edge of Tomorrow, which you mentioned briefly, when he plays Major Cage, what a ridiculous name, in that film, he does something really interesting with that role. You're right. He's kind of really
It's very meta because he's a celebrity soldier. And he's supposed to be like the hot, perfect representation of a soldier. But really, he's like this kind of prissy, doesn't want to get his hands dirty.
Yeah.
He's just like a celebrity. It feels like he's picking on Tom Cruise, where it's like, oh yeah, sure, you play an action star, but in real life, you're kind of a wuss.
Absolutely. And he's basically just a head of PR that's been made into a major so that he can have some top level clearance. That's basically it. And then he gets put in a war and he doesn't have the first clue about what to do.
Right.
And he basically just becomes cannon fodder. But again, like, that's a really interesting portrayal. That movie, did you know? So this is an interesting fact. That movie, they shot it and Tom Cruise saw it and he wasn't happy with it. So he paid an animator to animate the movie how he wanted it, and then did reshoots based on the animation that he had created for it.
Okay, is that real artist dedication or being a control freak? Being a weird control freak?
I mean, is there anything wrong with being a control freak when you're in charge of a movie, especially if it means that the final product is brilliant? You were just talking earlier about Christopher Nolan's brother, whose name I've totally forgotten, doing reshoots and being in control.
He didn't direct that movie. He's not the editor or the director.
He's
like
the producer, though.
I don't think he was.
Yeah,
I'm looking
is.
At the. I no, he's. And maybe he's an executive producer and he's not listed.
Nearly always. I think, as far as I know, ever since he split up from, when they split from Momentum in 2006, he's been the producer on every single film he's ever done.
It does not say it on Wikipedia.
Might be. But anyway, he definitely is always creatively involved. Without exception, he's involved from a creative perspective, because that's why he split from Momentum. They weren't giving him any creative control in Mission Impossible 3. But either way, I think that there's something kind of very underrated about his full level commitment, and especially in a genre that most people don't care about. As long as you've got guns and bullets and lots of people dying, you know, the action movies will, you know, they're popcorn fodder. They'll literally get people in and you can make money on them and you can turn a quick buck, and they're definitely not given the kind of level of commitment that I feel like he shows to the Mission Impossible franchise, for example, which for me is better than Bond. It's better than the Bourne Supremacy, Bourne franchise, whatever it's called. And I really enjoy it because I think that the commitment is quite clear.
I mean, there are definitely movies that of his I like, and as you're describing, like, this, his level of commitment, like, you know, you have to kind of respect somebody who's not just going to phone it in and just going to, you know, do whatever for a paycheck. And Edge of Tomorrow, I mean, I think one of the reasons why I liked him so much in that, and of course everyone likes him in Tropic Thunder, where he's like Les Grossman, is because there was like a, it seemed like an intentional effort put into like subvert his general, like, the perception that people have of him.
That's like, very possible.
Explicitly in Edge of Tomorrow, it felt like, you know, this is what you think of Tom Cruise, like this pretty boy actor who actually, you know, could never be an action star. And like, that's basically the character he's playing. And then, you know, Les Grossman is just like the complete opposite of however Tom Cruise has ever been presented as being, like, handsome and cool. And he's, you know, this like gross, literally he's gross, his name is Grossman, and he's a studio exec who's just like, he's supposed to be like Harvey Weinstein or somebody, who's just like this overbearing gross asshole, and they like put prosthetics on his fingers to make him like chubby and gross fingers. And yeah, and he's balding and like has splotches all over his head, and like those, I think there's a reason why those things resonated so much with him, is because it felt like he was kind of like picking on himself a little bit and intentionally subverting that public perception.
But he definitely, that's not rare though, Will. Like, he played Stacey Jacks in Rock of Ages. Like, he was literally this big celebrity that's actually finds, do you know about Rock of Ages, right? It's the,
I know of it, but I thought it was terrible.
Musical. Yeah, it's terrible, but he is brilliant in it. Like, it's a really bad musical, and I say that as someone who loves musicals. But he plays Stacey Jacks, who's this basically famous rock star who is really unsatisfied with his life because he's not creating anything of merit. He's just playing songs that he played all this time. Everyone wants to hear his old stuff. His new stuff is rubbish. He's got no muse, whatever. And he's playing this like super sexy rock star, and he sings Dead or Alive. It's so good. But, you know, and again, like, I feel like that is a kind of... that's him not taking himself too seriously, and also criticizing this idea about public perception and you as the artist being viewed.
I get that's like the JCVD and, you know, funny people, where like Adam Sandler's basically playing a version of himself who does, you know, this comedian who just does shitty movies and doesn't care anymore and has no interest. And like, it makes you more, it like rehumanizes this person who's become like, they're not a person anymore. They're just like this public image.
Yes.
So I'm with you on that. And so, I mean, I guess that means like, yeah, he has more depth than his public image. Like, he is a more complicated person than like the image that appears in people's minds when they hear the name Tom Cruise.
I'm definitely not trying to rehabilitate his character in any way, because I don't really care. I'm talking about it based on his body of work alone.
Right. But I'm saying his body of work kind of shows that there's more to him than his public image. And that he is probably underrated in terms of his, like, the level of, like, actual dedicated professional he is versus just some guy who shows up to be in action movies.
And I think it's not even just about him putting in that effort. I think that the movies, that effort is very obvious in them. So if we're taking the stunts as an example, the authenticity of the stunts make the action sequences in Mission Impossible much more interesting, for example. Yeah. So I think there's something, and like Edge of Tomorrow, I absolutely love that movie. So if he had anything to do with reshoots, because to make the story make more sense, bearing in mind that there's some time travel in that movie, which I'm always very critical of, because I think a lot of people use time travel paradoxes as a way to get out of actually writing a clearly constructed narrative. But yeah, so, you know, the fact that if he had anything to do with that, then again, that quality is shown in that film because it's absolutely wonderful. Bearing in mind as well that there's a lot of repetition in that film. They're doing the same scenes over and over again. And that could be really boring to watch, but there's something really enthralling about it.
Okay, so I agree with you about all this stuff, and I don't dislike Tom Cruise, but I'm on board with the, you know, his public image is not fair, and that he is an underrated actor. But why is he like the best actor? Why is he? Are you saying he's the best, or he's just your favorite?
He's my favorite. I love watching him. I can't really put it into words. I've been trying all week. I've been thinking, how am I going to talk about this on the podcast in a way that will be not just me being like, oh my God, he's amazing, in the way that I do when I talk about Sirius Black, for example. I think that I just love watching him. I think that his delivery is so brilliant. I think that his stunts are amazing. I think I find myself drawn to him when he's on screen, and I don't fancy him. Like, I am someone that is very much led by my boner. I do not, like, I do now, but it didn't start that way, in the way that it does with most people. Like, now I'm very drawn to him because that's just how my brain works, but I don't fancy him. So it's not even that, but when I see him on screen, I'm drawn to him, and I'm excited to see his movies, and I find them all enjoyable. Like, I've never seen a film of his that I have not enjoyed. And I include things like Jack Reacher, which if anyone else was in that film, I know I wouldn't have enjoyed it. I might have appreciated the artistry and how they filmed it, because as I said, it's filmed very much with the tone of an indie film, a much smaller budget, a much smaller production. It's very, I think it's about 8 members of the cast. It's a very small movie considering the genre. But I think if anyone else was in that, I wouldn't have enjoyed it so much. There's something really... When he plays comedy, it's so gleeful. When he plays action, it's so committed. When he plays, like, you know, the kind of the dark, dramatic performances like he gives in Born on the 4th of July, in Jerry Maguire and Magnolia, and some of his later stuff, Collateral, you know, really, he can be quite terrifying. He can be very...
Maybe I need to rewatch these.
I feel like I might make some recommendations at the end of this episode for movies for people to watch to try to... and then, you know, listeners can ring me up and say that I'm talking nonsense. But I feel like he's very accomplished across the board, you know, which very few actors are. Like, to be able to have that level of variety in your skill set is rare. Meryl Streep has it, but not a lot of people do. And I feel like he does.
You're definitely making me think more about how I feel about Tom Cruise.
My enthusiasm.
I mean, I don't have strong feelings about him, but I do. When there are movies of his that I watch, I mean, usually they are already like pre-approved. Like, someone has told me this is a good movie, you would like it, Edge of Tomorrow or something. Like, I always do enjoy him in it, and I don't find myself being like annoyed at him or being distracted by him being Tom Cruise. But I am always aware that like I don't feel like I can tell the distinction between Ethan Hunt and Tom Cruise, but maybe that's the nature of like action movies with a big star. So like, if I went back and rewatched A Few Good Men, or if I watched whatever you're going to recommend, then I could like maybe be more lost in the character instead of it just being Tom Cruise.
I mean, I think
like that's my biggest issue with him. That's why I like it when he subverts his public image, because it's so strong. Like, it's so, he's so intensely Tom Cruise to me that I it's hard for me to feel like, oh, this isn't Tom Cruise. He is Lestat here.
Yeah. I mean, and a part of that is definitely like what we talked about earlier. Like, he's so famous. Like, it's really hard, right, I think, to separate them. Like, And I'd agree with you. Like when Bruce Willis, for example, is in Friends, he's just playing Bruce Willis. Like, you know, he's right. not playing whoever he is, Rachel's boyfriend. I mean,
when he's in all the Die Hard movies, like John McClane is basically Bruce Willis.
Yeah, totally. And then you see him in interviews and you're like, oh, wow, you're like not acting. It's like how we were really surprised when we found out that Orlando Bloom couldn't act because we thought he was acting as Legolas, but it turns out Legolas is just his character.
That's who he is. Yeah,
that's just who he is. I mean, you know, that's just his character. So I think there's definitely...
Brad Pitt and Leo, to me, defy that more often than I would expect. There are times, like in Revenant, that I was not constantly reminded that I was watching Leo DiCaprio. And obviously he's got like a lot of makeup and he's got a big beard and stuff on. But like he was that character during that movie to me. Like I was not always thinking I'm watching Leo.
I mean, there were definitely moments within that film where I felt the same way, but I think he always does that thing where he breaks his voice. Do you know what I'm talking about? I can't do an impression of it. I might try. Maybe. If you don't know what I'm talking about. When he goes,
or his voice cracks when he's screaming. Or
his voice
something?
Cracks when he's talking. And he does it in like every single movie that he's in. So like he's got definitely, that's an actor's tick that he's got. And I think there are some other things that he does as well that are very much
that kind of remind you
that remind me that it's him, that pulls me out of it. And Tom Cruise probably has some as well, but I think every actor does to an extent. If I compare Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt, I think probably Brad Pitt has more variety in his roles. But the problem with that is that when Brad Pitt's not playing the guy in Ocean's 11 or whatever, he's rubbish. He does have variety in his roles, but he's not good at the variety. He doesn't deliver in the way that I would hope for him to.
Maybe he isn't.
Do you want to give me an example where you think this isn't? Sorry, that sounded really aggressive. Try and help me. Do you want to give me an example where you think he's done something different that he's actually quite good at?
I mean, I might be breaking the rules because I'm going back to early days when you see
That's
him.
Okay,
in like
I've done it.
12 Monkeys or something.
12 Monkeys. Oh, Bruce Willis is in that movie. Sorry, mm-hmm. It was awful. So
but
cool.
Like he, was he in? I'm trying to think.
I'm putting you on the spot. Sorry.
No, it's okay. I'm like trying to look up his filmography to see like what are the recent movies that I've seen him in.
So he did like World War Z, and he was rubbish in that.
No, he's I mean, The Big Short. I don't even remember who he was in The Big Short.
He did that film Moneyball where he played the baseball guy, but
yeah, I didn't see it.
I think
I haven't seen Fury. I haven't seen 12 Years a Slave.
You know,
After Reading, he was like not him, his normal self.
He was so goofy in that film. Loved it.
But I think a lot of times he basically, I mean, the Ocean's movies, he's Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
Mr. and Mrs. Smith, you know, Inglourious Basterds, he was kind of like, you know, he was doing his like weird accent, but like he was still very Brad Pittish.
So I can definitely
see. It's hard to get out from under that.
It is hard. And as we talked about, like there's so much submersion and like movies are literally sold on the fact that the stars are in it. So they've been cast because they want the stars to deliver whatever quality it is that they have. So there's always going to be an element of it. I would argue that Tom Cruise doesn't have any more actor's ticks than someone like Leonardo DiCaprio does. And I think also, Leo aside, because I think Leo is good in everything that he's in as well. I would argue that Tom Cruise is good in all of his films, even if the movie itself is not great, like Night and Day, his performance is very good in it. Whereas, you know, if you look at someone like, I don't want to punch down and talk about Nicolas Cage, but Nicolas Cage is just a really good example. Like, he was quite good back in the day, and now he's just like appalling, and you're just, I don't understand why. It's like he's given up on life. I can't get my head around it. And the thing is that level of commitment seems missing, because Nicolas Cage is obsessed with Ghost Rider. Like, he has a Ghost Rider tattoo, and yet he's made two appalling Ghost Rider films. So, you know, there's some disappointment.
It's hard to know what Nick Cage's, what his enthusiasm produces.
Where's his motivation? Because
there's times where I think Nick Cage is going, he is so enthusiastic about this, and it's a garbage, terrible role, but I also love it because I can see he's like, I'm just super into this, and I'm just going to scream and be a crazy Nick Cage person. Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I love watching Nicolas Cage movies. If Nicolas Cage movies have 1-star rating on Netflix, I will watch it. I will find time in my diary to watch it because I love it. But it's not good.
No, this is I'm trying to think of like, when have I seen a performance from Tom Cruise where I've been like, he's not selling this at all. He sucks. It's hard to think of one.
Yeah, I think he'll struggle.
Yeah, but are there ones of Bruce Willis like that? I feel like Bruce Willis is, you know, he's an okay actor. Are there movies where he's rubbish in Red? Oh, I've seen Red.
He's just lame.
Seems like he's just bored. Yeah, he's
really blasé in it. He's not great in the last Die Hard film, even though he's playing his, you know, his most famous role. He's kind of rubbish in it. Has the tagline "Yippee-ki-yay, Mother Russia," so probably a good thing that you haven't. But my full commitment was amazing. Yes, appalling. My full commitment to action movies means that I have seen it. But I think that I could find Leonardo DiCaprio aside, I could find bad movies for all of the other actors, but I'm not sure that I can with as in bad performances, not just bad movies, bad performances. For all the other actors, but I don't know if I've ever seen a bad performance from Tom Cruise, and that's another reason that he's my favorite, because I know that I'm going to go and see it and I will enjoy the film because his performance will lift it, even if the rest of the film is shit, like Night and Day.
All right, well, listeners can message us or tweet us or write in and tell us about bad Tom Cruise performances.
Yeah. I mean, I would love everyone to tell me their favorite Tom Cruise movie, and then I can enthuse about it with them. And I'm very happy to be dragged on Twitter for this relatively obscure opinion.
Before you give recommendations, though, I have one more question for you.
Go.
Who would you, or in what role would you dream cast Tom Cruise in? Like, if you could pick, maybe even not even a specific role, but like a franchise, like, would you want to see him as? He's never been a superhero, has he? He's never been like a Marvel character. Has he been in a horror movie? I mean, Interview with a Vampire, kind of, but like.
Yeah,
has he ever played a villain
horror,
in a horror movie or something, or a villain in a thriller? I don't think so.
I would love to see him take on more villain roles for sure, because he does he sometimes plays an anti-hero, like Collateral, he's an anti-hero. Edge of Tomorrow, he's kind of an anti-hero, whatever. But he very rarely takes on a full villainous role, which would be very interesting to see. A franchise that I'd love to see him in.
Les Grossman, he's kind of the bad guy, but not really. Like,
he's also only in it for about 7 minutes, and most of that he's dancing to Flo Rida. That thing is funny though. That scene is funny. I would love to have seen him play something in so he did Last Samurai, which was a big epic, but I would love to see him in something like a big epic fantasy, because he's never done that genre. And in the same way that he brings real gravitas to the action genre, which is also always overlooked and snubbed, I think that he could bring something really authentic to a big sort of big fantasy film or something like that. He does a lot of science fiction, but I'd like to see him in some fantasy.
I mean, maybe this is because it would undermine his image a little bit, but like, I could see him in some supporting roles. I think that's part of the thing, is like, he always is the leading man.
He is. And well, like, he's getting Harrison too old Ford for that has now. Been a,
yeah, like Harrison Ford has been, you know, a supporting character in different movies, and like, it would be cool to see him as not as the hero, but as somebody else who is, I mean, maybe that is the villain, or maybe that's just like some kind of sidekick or something. I mean, I don't know. I think I just want him to be not the action hero leading star.
I mean, the only films that he's really like that in, like Magnolia, he's in an ensemble cast, so he's not in it, but he's a scene stealer. That is part of the problem with casting him as a, you know, supporting actor, because he does just, I mean, he's very good. So he steals the scenes, I think. But yeah, that would be nice to see. I think as he gets older, it will be harder for him to be the leading man. Although he is in incredible shape. It's absolutely, I mean, his knees must be battered. That's all I think about. It's one thing to have all the muscle and be very lean, but like, after a while, your joints just give up. You know what I mean? But yeah, I mean, eventually he's going to have to start taking a back seat. So it'll be interesting. I agree. Supporting roles more, some villain stuff would be amazing. And I would love to see him in a fantasy, but I don't know if he'll ever go down that route. I mean, he's had 36 years to do it. He probably won't do it at this stage, but maybe he could be a villain as a supporting role in a fantasy genre. There you
maybe.
Go.
I mean, so you take people like Lee Pace, and Lee Pace is willing to like put on a bunch of makeup and be in the Hobbit movies or be the bad guy in Guardians of the Galaxy.
For real. Yeah.
I would be into Tom Cruise doing that.
Yeah, maybe he'll be in Marvel and all my dreams will come true. You never know.
What Marvel superhero would you want him to be, or villain?
Oh my god.
He probably could have been a decent been Tony Red Stark. Skull.
Oh, he could have been.
Had what's his name not kind of absorbed that role into his own personality.
It's so difficult to Robert think Downey of Jr. Tony Stark not being RDJ, isn't it? They're so like intrinsic. It's the same thinking about Cap being anyone but Chris Evans. Did you know John Krasinski was going to be Captain America before Chris Evans? How weird is that?
I could kind of see that.
He'd be like
Jim
in the camera. It was so weird.
Yeah, he'd be doing the camera. That's true.
I mean, he would have been a good Red Skull. He'd have been good at that. But yeah, I don't know. I'm only saying that because basically I wanted him to be in a film with Chris Evans. That's the only motivation for casting him as the Red Skull. I don't know. I don't know what Marvel villain he would be good at.
He would have been a good Cyclops, I feel like, at some point.
Because he looks like James Marsden?
Maybe because he looks like James Marsden.
They look the same. They've both got that like 90s cute boy haircut with the big teeth. Yeah.
I'm trying to look at pictures of Cyclops, but that's also kind of how Cyclops looks. He's
it is. Oh,
no,
it's
pretty boy, and he has like the tousled brunette hair, and
that is James Marsden's best role. He's totally underrated as Cyclops. He's so good at it.
That is not his best role.
Yeah, it is.
By the way, James Marsden is in Westworld, and he is surprising. He's underrated. I see him in Westworld. I'm like, I kind of like what you're doing with this guy.
He was really funny in 30 Rock. I loved him in that as well.
Yeah. I don't know. I could see him being a Cyclops. I'm trying to think of other. I feel like he has to undermine the like pretty boy image it has to like buy into that to some degree.
It's difficult for us to see because he could have done Magneto, but it's so hard to not see
McKellen.
Why can't he do Magneto? Just because
he's too
your favorite.
Young looking. He looks like he looks a little boy. He looks like a kid.
He's 53 years old.
Yeah, but he still looks that. Magneto doesn't look like a young, pretty boy.
Maybe not. But you could just, you could salt and pepper him or age him up a bit.
He could be like a Gambit.
I don't know Gambit well enough. Wasn't Gambit played by Box Office Poison? What's his name? The guy who plays Tim Riggins?
I don't know.
In Friday Night Lights.
In X-Men Origins or in Wolverine Origins or whatever. I blanked out most of that movie.
Oh, he was bad in that, poor thing. I don't know. Maybe. Be great. Oh, I could dream cast him.
He should be a serial killer. He should be a serial killer in some like really intense thriller. Like Robin Williams in like 1 hour photo or whatever.
Oh my God, I love that film. God, I haven't thought about that film for such a long time.
Yeah. So I think I don't know. Maybe, but anyway, okay.
Maybe a villain. I'm with you.
I accept your... I'll reevaluate Tom Cruise.
Really?
Now. I mean, I don't dislike him, but I like him in every role, and I can't think of any time I haven't that I've thought he's given a bad performance. So, whatever. Best actor in the world.
I said my favorite actor, and he's definitely a contender. He's up there. He's top five.
What?
Definitely, for sure. He's up there with Leo.
Top five best actors. I don't even think Leo is in the top five.
Leo's definitely in top five.
Okay. Is this just men?
Yeah.
All right, fine. So just in top male actors, you think those two are in the top five?
I'd say so.
Think he's better than like...
Oh, should we play
Anthony
this game
Hopkins
for 10 seconds?
And
yes.
William H. Macy and...
I love William H. Macy in The Cooler and a couple of other films, but in general, I find him to be overrated.
What about, like, I'm trying to think of other, who are, like, amazingly acclaimed actors that can do anything? You think he's better than, I don't know. Who are considered, like, the best actors in the world?
Better than Dustin Hoffman. He's better than Ed Harris. He's better than Anthony Hopkins.
He's not better than Anthony Hopkins.
He is.
What about Jack Nicholson and...
I don't like Jack Nicholson. Morgan Freeman and
Daniel Day-Lewis and...
Daniel Day-Lewis is probably better than him. Probably. But I think one of the things that Tom Cruise has that other actors don't have is consistency. So like one of the reasons I'm really excited about Rogue One is because I'm really excited to see Forest Whitaker and hopefully he'll be good, but he's an inconsistent actor. And, you know, Anthony Hopkins is inconsistent. Ed Harris is inconsistent. I love Ed Harris, but he's inconsistent.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what I think is great about Tom Cruise, Leonardo DiCaprio, consistency.
Okay.
Denzel Washington, maybe. Consistent, you know?
Good. He's in bad movies sometimes, but I always enjoy him. He's in bad movies,
but his performance is always good. Yeah. And he's consistent, okay. You know?
All right. So what are your recommendations here? What should people watch if they want to like get on the Tom Cruise bus?
I've made some recommendations based on variety. So I've actually talked about a few of these in the podcast. There's some synergy there. So if you haven't seen Top Gun, see Top Gun, because aside from anything, it's a cultural like touchstone. Everyone has to see Top Gun. It was easily the most popular film in the 80s. So everyone has to see Top Gun. I would suggest watching Interview with the Vampire because he's really camp and amazing in that film. It's very ridiculous and it is exactly what you would expect a vampire film shot in the early 90s to be like. Definitely, if you're going to watch any of the Mission Impossibles, watch Mission Impossible 4, directed by Brad Bird, who's one of mine and Will's favorite directors. And it's actually a fantastic film. It's got the best...
Yeah, that movie's awesome.
The best stunt I've ever seen in film or television in that movie. Definitely watch Magnolia. I've talked about it a lot. It's one of his best performances. It's definitely one of his most unique performances. And aside from anything, if you're not too fussed about Tom Cruise, he's not in it a lot. And there's a lot of other brilliant performances in there, including Philip Seymour Hoffman, Julianne Moore, a couple of others. Definitely watch Collateral for similar reasons. He plays an anti-hero, which you don't often see Tom Cruise doing. It's directed by Michael Mann, so it's stunning to look at. It's like lots of really amazing shots of Los Angeles. And it's just a really tense film. It's kind of like Phone Booth with Colin Farrell. Like, it's really tense. It's largely in one set, and it's really, really good. And of his current kind of sci-fi films, I've got to recommend Edge of Tomorrow. Fantastic film. Really fun to watch. Emily Blunt is super hot in it and does hot yoga, which is such a treat to watch. But it's a good film. It's a good sci-fi action thriller, and he's great in it. There you go.
And those will all be in the show notes.
They will all be in the show notes. Thank you, Will. Oh, that was so fun. I talked about Tom Cruise for like an hour. What a day.
Dream come true.
It really is. Yeah, so people get in touch with me on Twitter, on Facebook, on the Facebook fan page for the show. Let me know what you think about Tom Cruise. I'm interested if there are any other fans out there. I feel like I'm a lone voice in a sea of DiCaprio fanboys, so I'd be interested.
And to see the show notes for every show, if your podcast app has a show notes feature, you can see them in there. And if not, you can go to whydoyoucare.fm, which is our website. And if you click on the show and scroll down, there are links to the things that we've said will be in the show notes.
Cool.
Awesome. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
And thanks to Joshua Duchesne for this theme music that you're hearing. And we'll see you guys soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye.